and welcome to the latest episode of the GLA podcast, the Global Law at Reading podcast. I'm your host, Dr. James Green. This episode features a panel discussion entitled Am I Charlie? Featuring comments from four members of the University of Reading staff, Professor Susan Brough, who's the head of School of Law, Dr. Christina Helmich, who's from the Department of Politics and International Relations, Dr. Brian Feltham, who's also from the Politics and IR Department, and Dr. Ruby Ziegler, who's from the School of Law. The panel was set up to consider issues relating to freedom of speech in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attacks that occurred in Paris on the 7th of January 2015. And the event took place, it was a rapid response panel, and it took place just 2 weeks after the attacks on Wednesday, the 21st of January 2015. The panel was chaired and introduced by Professor Dominic Zaum, who's the head of the School of Politics, Economics and International Relations here at Reading. So Dominic's voice will be the first one you hear on the recording. To ensure free and frank discussion and to limit any concerns given the sensitive nature of this topic about individual consent, the decision was taken that we would only record the comments made by the four speakers on the panel. So none of the subsequent discussion is featured on this podcast for what we felt were sensible reasons. I'll hand over to the podcast. Before I do, a reminder as ever to email us at globallaw@reading.ac.uk with any comments, or you can tweet us at UNIRDG_GLA.
Everybody to this event, which I think is now called Am I Charlie?
Yes.
Am I Charlie? Okay. Which is, of course, inherently, I think it doesn't require much explanation about the question of freedom of speech in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris. Journalists are among the group that kind of receive special protection. And we are very concerned about if journalists get arrested or killed, even more than many other groups, because of the centrality of a free press and a free media to the democratic process and to the ability, of course, to maintain a public sphere and a public debate. It's therefore an important topic to discuss, but of course equally important is that freedom of speech is never unfettered. It is controlled and limited even in democratic societies for perfectly defensible and justifiable reasons. We have four presenters here today who I'll introduce very briefly in a moment, who come to this to this topic from very different perspectives, both disciplinary, from law and from politics, different kind of geographic backgrounds, and also very different positions on the particular issues. So, and in a way, their remarks, which will be very brief, as they have all assured me, and which I will make sure by curtailing their right to speech after 5 minutes, really serve to frame a discussion. Now, as you all know, discussions around this topic have been extremely heated, and people have very strong views around those. Universities are a place for free speech, but also a place for respectful dialogue. Yeah. Universities are a place of pluralism. So can I encourage you all, in that spirit, to respect the views of any other discussion in this, any other contribution in this discussion, and ensure that this remains a civilized dialogue rather than a series of ad hominem arguments into which we do not want this to descend. Just a few points of order. This whole the presentations are recorded and will go on somewhere on the university website.
On the Global Law at Reading.
On the Global Law at Reading website. We will not record the discussion because we cannot get everybody's consent form signed for this. So we will only record the contributions of the four speakers here and not the rest. And I will say a bit more about how we run the discussion when we come to that point. But let me start off with our first speaker, Professor Susan Brough, the head of the School of Law. Then we will have Dr. Christina Helmich, who is a reader in, well, now associate professor, now the title of our changed, in Middle Eastern Politics. Then we have Dr. Brian Feltham first, who is a lecturer in political theory, and then Dr. Ruvit Ziegler, who is a lecturer in law. So, Susan, 5 minutes.
Well, this started off by a discussion in my office between Ruvi and Christina and myself when I indicated how upset I was about the attacks in Paris. Now, foolishly, I have over 300 friends on Facebook. I posted the big picture, Je suis Charlie. Well, you can imagine the reaction I got from some of my more thoughtful students and some of the more thoughtful academics saying that I hadn't really considered both sides of this argument. And I totally accept that. But je suis Charlie. I'm sorry, I've now considered both sides of the argument. And I want to remind you of something. In 1933, one of the first things that the Nazis did is they burned the books. Your assignment is to go and watch that. Sit there and watch it. I think the most important aspect about not only the post-Second World War arrangement, but something that has been in existence internationally, as an international lawyer, has been the freedom to speak, the freedom to have ideas. And the first casualty in any kind of dictatorship is the freedom to speak. And ISIS is a dictatorship. It is one of the scourges on our society. I'm sorry, but I make no bones about it, because anyone who can publish a document saying that slavery of women is acceptable should be wiped off the face of the earth. And I feel very strongly about that, as you can imagine. Now, saying that, however, I would never have bought Charlie Hebdo. Never. I think insulting a religion is wrong. I also think it might, and there's an argument, that it violates the European Convention on Human Rights section on freedom of expression, which says, the exercise of these freedoms, since it carries with it duties and responsibilities, may be subject to such formalities, conditions, restrictions, or penalties as are prescribed by law and are necessary in a democratic society in the interests of national security, territorial integrity, or public safety, for the prevention of disorder or crime, for the protection of health or morals, for the protection of the reputation or rights of others, for preventing the disclosure of information received in confidence, or for maintaining the authority and impartiality of the judiciary. I think sometimes Charlie Hebdo really got close to that line. But there were legal ways to deal with that. There were due process ways to deal with that. We do not prescribe, because there's the second right, freedom of expression, but what's the second paramount right? The right to life. We do not have the right to be personal executioners against anyone who disagrees with us. We have abolished the death penalty in Europe, and I have been a long-standing campaigner against the abolishment of the death penalty universally. And third, one of the things that I'm concerned about in terms of this whole debate is we are not discussing the real risk to international peace and security that ISIS forming a separate sovereign state forms. I will remind you again of Winston Churchill in the 1930s, who everybody thought was crazy. They said he was completely crazy to predict that Hitler would be the scourge of mankind. Well, I am telling you, and I am putting it on record, that if we allow ISIS to continue, they could be the scourge of mankind, and I'm finished.
Excellent, thank you.
Right, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not going to talk about law, and I am wondering as to how far our positions might be apart though otherwise.
I think a lot.
But never mind. The attacks in Paris were a hideous crime, and in my view it should be seen as that. There's a couple of things I want to remind you of. And first one is that freedom of speech and freedom of press is not challenged by gunmen running around in the streets, but is ultimately challenged by the government response. It's the state that ultimately controls freedom of speech and freedom of expression. It's particularly important to keep this in mind in times of terror. The risk nowadays, and in the days since 9/11, is being deemed a terrorist when taking sides with the other side. And I'm talking here about taking sides with Muslim grievances, generally speaking. This can range from being pro-Palestinian to talking about injustices against Muslims in Iraq at the hand of Western countries. These kind of issues are more likely to be considered terrorist propaganda And it's this kind of rhetoric that can get you into trouble. Maybe a good example here is the case of journalist James Risen, who has been very, very outspoken about the atrocities that have been committed by states, and he is talking about the United States in the war on terror, and he has been silenced over and over again. It is this side that has my greater concern. It is also with an eye on the political side, the political nature of the current situation, that Muslims and Muslim communities in the post 9/11 world have been demonized and policed excessively, all under the umbrella of potential terrorists in the making. I find that concerning. Is it, in that in mind, appropriate to make fun of Islam and the Prophet at a time when we have already a significant power imbalance with a minority within our countries? I find that kind of othering very worrisome. That leads me to a bigger point that I would like to remind you of, and that is the one of respect. Isn't a foundation of our peaceful with one another, not just having rights, but also respecting the rights of one another. And respect seems to be a very important matter here. Is it appropriate to be mean and hurtful to somebody else just because we can? My final point is quite simple. There have been limits precisely because of hurting others is inappropriate when there is a significant history and reason to do so. A couple of examples. Hate speech is not something we have allowed. Or maybe another example, one that is extremely dear to me as a German citizen, is the Holocaust denial. That would get you into serious trouble. So the idea that we have no limitations of freedom of speech is something to keep in mind. So I just want to close on, just because we can and just because it's legal doesn't mean that we should. Thank you.
Okay, well, I'm a philosopher, and I've been invited along today to say something not directly about the empirical facts of the matter, but rather about some of the normative arguments standing behind freedom of speech. I think it would help clarify what I'm going to say if I start out by just indicating my own position on freedom of speech, which is I'm rather attached to it. And indeed, to such an extent that I am deeply troubled by hate speech legislation. I believe to form a full and considered judgment on hate speech legislation would require a greater degree of knowledge of the law and of also empirical considerations about the effects of the law before I could make a final decision. But I will say that coming at it to start with, I would be oppositional to hate speech legislation. So I'm very much in favour of freedom of speech. But what I want to talk about today is something slightly different, about toleration, and about the kinds of intoleration that we do have and that many of us are in various ways comfortable with. Now, John Stuart Mill famously offered arguments for freedom of speech. I don't think his arguments are successful entirely, but they are to some degree significant and partially persuasive. What I'm interested in today, though, is not the arguments for freedom of speech, but a distinction he makes between two different ways of limiting it. Now, one of them is state censorship. And it is worth reflecting on the question of whether it's only states that can censor. This would be a conceptual question as to what counts as censorship. A feature of censorship is that an authority bans a certain area of speech or expression and will use violence to enforce their ban. Now, as I've expressed it there, it doesn't require that authority to be a state or to be a political authority. Perhaps it does have to be a political authority. I think it would be very surprising if censorship required states, as if before there were states there was no censorship. There were other forms of political authority. Okay, so one is that kind of enforced censorship, and there's a conceptual question as to whether lunatics killing people with guns when they don't like what they say, claiming authority to do so, is an act of censorship in that sense, or if it's not. That's an interesting conceptual question I'm just throwing out there. But the other form of constraining freedom of speech is social pressure. And we do, in various ways, take steps in our society to limit social pressure affecting people's freedom of expression. For example, that's one thing that anti-harassment laws do. They prevent you using harassment to limit people's behaviour, the things they express, the way they live their lives. So we do take a stand against that. What I want to suggest, though, is that many of us will be comfortable with using social pressure as a way of constraining people's expression. And in particular, there's a way in which I am comfortable with using social pressure in order to limit expression. And in particular, for me, this would be highly misogynistic language, highly misogynistic expression. What I think is appropriate here is not a legal ban, but that each of us has the courage to stand up against it whenever we encounter it. I don't expect all of us to always be so brave. I certainly don't expect it of myself, though I do think I ought to do it. That is to say, I think that with social pressure, we can persuade people that's not okay. We don't like that way of speaking, we don't like your ideas, and we're going to take a stand against it every time you try to express it. That's a kind of social pressure there. Another area where we might have social pressure is one that was mentioned earlier, Holocaust denial. Okay. So how far would we tolerate Holocaust denial? How long would I keep my job if I was a Holocaust denier, boss? Perhaps there would be protections for me because we have to protect academic expression, right? I simply don't know how far that would extend. But I can tell you that my good friend Christina would stop talking to me. there are things that we don't tolerate. So what I want to finish on is offending deliberately people's very deeply held convictions that matter very much to them something that we should be socially intolerant of? Now, this may not apply to every deeply held conviction, for instance, the deeply held convictions of a white supremacist. But it may apply to some deeply held convictions. Islam, and that version of Islam, or versions of Islam that prohibit depictions of the Prophet, would seem to me to be worthy of respect. And perhaps this is an area where we should be more intolerant of certain kinds of speech. But only socially, not legally. Thanks.
Thank you. I was kind of hoping at some point that I would hear something that would spark me to disagree, at least in the last sentence. But because the objection Brian voiced was a social one rather than a legal one, that we have no disagreement on that level. But what I want to do, being a rather boring lawyer, is I do want to make a legal distinction, which I believe is also the one that exists under international law, between blasphemy laws, which I think have no place in a free society, and laws that concern the restriction on incitement to hatred, discrimination, or violence, which do have a place and have a rightful place. And the reason this is not a moot point is that the following language was a common law offence in this country until 2008. The publication of matter which vilifies or is contemptuous, of which denies the truth of the Christian religion or the Bible or the Book of Common Prayer, and which is couched in indecent, scurrilous, or offensive terms likely to shock and outrage the feelings of the general body of Christian believers. This was repealed by the Justice and Immigration Act 2008. Similar laws still exist in Germany, in Poland, in Ireland, and in 22% of the world's countries, right? So blasphemy laws are very much still there on the books. And I want to argue blasphemy laws are problematic on two counts. First, what they intend to do, either in law or in effect, in the context of the UK, it was both in law and in effect, is not to protect minorities, it's to protect majorities. It's to protect the right, or the supposed right, of the majority of the population whose religion is the one protected by the state, not to be offended. This is what we still see today when countries that are Islamic states prohibit the publication of caricatures related to Islam, like Saudi Arabia, but they wouldn't prohibit the publication of similarly offensive language against other religions. And we saw this in the UK as well. In the UK, it's the Wingrove case before the European Court of Human Rights, and in other cases, the fact is that states have only applied blasphemy laws to protect the majority religion. And so blasphemy laws for that reason shouldn't be on the books, but they shouldn't be on the books for another reason, which Brian has also alluded to, which is that in a free society, what we do have a right to is not to be discriminated against and not to be subjected to violence and not to be killed. What we don't have a right that should be protected by the state through restriction of other people's speech is the right not to be offended. We certainly have the right not to buy Charlie Hebdo. We have the right to demonstrate against Charlie Hebdo. We don't have the right to ask the state to prohibit Charlie Hebdo from being published. And the reason we do, I think, have a right not to be discriminated against, which necessitates to some extent a limited form of restriction of speech, is because when it comes to hate speech and to discriminatory speech and to speech that incites to violence, actually, as opposed to what happens with blasphemy laws, there it is far more likely that the groups that will be targeted, and so that the state has a positive duty to protect, are actually minority groups, a vulnerable group in society. These are the groups that we see often being discriminated against. These are the groups that are often having hate speech directed towards them, like the EDL in this country. And there the state actually has a positive duty to intervene in the name not just of the right to life, which Susan spoke about, but also of the right to equality and non-discrimination. So I conclude by saying, all those countries that still have blasphemy laws should repeal them. All those countries that don't have laws that prohibit incitement to violence or hatred or discrimination should introduce them. Thank you.